Support for On Being with Krista Tippett comes from the Fetzer Institute, helping build the spiritual foundation for a loving world. Fetzer envisions a world that embraces love as a guiding principle and animating force for our lives, a powerful love that helps us live in sacred relationship with ourselves, others, and the natural world. Learn more by visiting Fetzer.org.
There's a question floating around the world right now. How can we be joyful in a moment like this? To which Ross Gay responds in word and deed, how can we not be joyful, especially in a moment like this? He is a writer, a gardener, also a former college football player. To be with him is to train your gaze to see what's terrible, but also to see what's wonderful and beautiful. To attend to and meditate on what you love, even within the work of justice. We practice tenderness and mercy in part because to understand that we are all suffering is one quality of what Ross Gay calls adult joy.
It is joy by which the labor that will make the life that I want possible. It is not at all puzzling to me that joy is possible in the midst of difficulty.
I'm Krista Tippett, and this is On Being. Ross Gay is a professor of English at Indiana University, Bloomington, and a writer of poetry as well as essays. This conversation unfolded at the Loft Literary Center's 2019 Wordplay Festival, a brand new national book festival in Minneapolis.
So, you grew up between, you were born in Youngstown, Ohio, mm-hmm. and grew up in Levittown, mm-hmm. Pennsylvania, a lineage of farmers and teachers. Mm-hmm. So interesting to me, also, your parents were a mixed-race couple mm-hmm. in the, I guess they got married in the era of Loving versus Virginia. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You write a lot about how your mother, especially as she got older, your mother was white, your father's black, that she started to talk about what it was like mm-hmm. to get married then. And I feel like that's such an important story that we tell ourselves mm-hmm. because things have changed mm-hmm. so much in that regard, mm-hmm. at least. Mm-hmm. Say a little bit about, you know, what you got from what your parents getting, just your parents getting married meant.
Yeah, it's sort of amazing to me, like, My mother, so as I say, she sort of is talking more about their life together, which was many things, and among them was like this sort of, you know, difficulty that mostly they didn't talk about. And, you know, that's like sort of part of my, I realize that's part of my, like, one of the many things that I'm sort of constantly curious about, like, what was it like? And my mother does tell some things now, you know, and but I sometimes think of their experiences and I just, you know, I'm just sort of curious about what are the sort of sorrows that they were just sort of like not, you know.
And also that people would say to her, of course you can do this and just know you've doomed your children.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, totally, yeah. My mom, she says, yeah, Aunt Sylvia, she's the one who said it was gonna be fine.
Okay.
Yeah.
Totally. I just wanted to name that because it feels, you know, it's almost like she's a first generation. It's like the first generation of trauma, uh-huh. first generation of people who make it through something that mm-hmm. feels unimaginable.
Yeah.
Often don't talk about it.
Yeah.
And now we're in such a different place with uh-huh. that.
Yeah.
But that's also part of the story of how we got here.
Right. Yeah.
So your last two books are The Book of Delights and the Catalog of Unabashed Gratitudes. I usually start my conversations by asking about the spiritual background of someone's childhood, mm-hmm. however you would think about that now. I'm really curious with you where you trace the origins of being attuned to delights and unabashed gratitudes. Where's that come from?
That's a really good question. To some extent, I feel like I've always loved the smell of honeysuckle, you know? I feel like I could love stuff, you know, really love stuff. I feel like I've had periods of my life where it's been harder to sort of be like that. But I also feel like, you know, my folks sort of modeled a certain kind. I recently remembered this story, and I will never unremember it, that my dad told us, me and my brother, we were in the car, and I guess we wanted to push the windshield wiper fluid button. And my dad wanted us not to, and told us that if we pushed it, he said that picture on there was a flower, and the car would turn into a flower. Which makes him like a hero. And then he said, and a big bee will come and sting you.
That's so great.
But it's amazing, right?
Right.
And I kind of like...
That it wouldn't turn into a monster.
Yeah. It wouldn't turn into a monster. Yeah. But that was like, for years, I actually thought that that button made the, you know... And so anytime I look at that button, I mean, not anytime, but often when I look at that button, I'm like, oh, that's a flower, you know? And for years, I did believe that it would turn. And I got to ask my brother, too, if he also thought that for years. But I don't know. I feel like in some way my folks sort of did some of that for me,
And just were like that.
In some ways, and in some ways not, too.
Yeah.
In some ways, just like going to work and taking care of stuff and like boom, 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 boom. But I know that the older I get, the more I can sort of point to things that were like, oh yeah, my mother was really good at that,
Mm-hmm.
My father was really good at that. My brother was really good at that,
With her family from Minnesota,
mm-hmm.
and they were farmers.
Yeah, Verndale, Minnesota.
Verndale, Minnesota. Yeah.
Anyone from Verndale? No, no.
No takers.
It's 500 people in Verndale.
I kept thinking when I was reading you and getting ready to be with you, about how sometime last year I was at a gathering of, a lot of philanthropists and leaders of nonprofits, people who are doing good in the world and want to do good in the world. And someone said to me, one of these people who was in a position of leadership said, how can we possibly be joyful in a moment like this? And I feel like your entire body of work and what you're articulating as you also navigate this moment we live in is a response to that.
Mm-hmm.
And is strangely countercultural.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
To see joy, I would say this is just a simplified way and I want you to expand on it, but to see joy as a calling precisely in a moment like this.
Yeah. And that's the thing, it's like joy, sometimes I think there's a conception of joy as meaning something like something easy, And to me, joy has nothing to do with ease. And joy has everything to do with the fact that we're all going to die. Like that's actually, when I'm thinking about joy, I'm thinking about that at the same time as like something wonderful is happening, some connection is being made in my life, we are also in the process of dying. That is every moment. Mm-hmm. That is every moment. And
let's say some more about that connection for you.
The connection between the dying and and the joy.
Yeah.
Well, part of it is just, the sort of simple fact of the ephemerality of, and maybe this is a little veering off, but there is this thing of like, if you and I know we're each in the process, there's something that will happen between us, like there's some kind of tenderness that might be possible. Not always going to happen because I might just get scared and like do something else. But there's a potential, I think, for some kind of tenderness. And this is the thing that's been interesting about writing that Delights book is that it has sort of articulated for me a way that, my question is joy. Like my sort of question that I could see that's a life question is like, what is this joy or how joy? But in the process of sort of thinking about it, I have really been thinking that like joy is the moments for me, the moments when my alienation from people, but not just people, from the whole thing, it goes away and it shrinks. If it was a visual thing, like everything becomes luminous, and I love that mycelium, like the sort of forest metaphor that there's this thing connecting us. And among the things of that thing connecting us is that we have this common experience.
Mm-hmm.
Many common experiences, but like a really foundational one is that we are not here forever. And that's a joining and joining,
right.
So that's sort of how I think about it.
Is a common experience also our capacity for joy, kind of in and through and despite that?
Say it again.
So one thing that bothered me about this idea that joy couldn't be possible is that joy is somehow a luxury or a privilege.
Yeah, that's
right?
Just fucking dumb.
And it seems to me that joy... Yeah. Yeah. Okay, we can't put that on public radio, but okay.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Sorry. Yeah.
But yeah, but joy is our a capacity for joy despite and through.
Yeah.
That.
Yeah.
The fact that we're all going to die.
Right.
And then things are going wrong all the time.
Right, right, right.
It's also something that joins us together.
Totally, totally. And it, I mean, it's sort of like...
It's leveling in a way.
Yeah, yeah. And it's sort of like it is joy by which the labor that will make the life that I want possible.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And it is not at all puzzling to me that joy is possible in the midst of difficulty.
Yeah. So the Book of Delights... You promised yourself to write a mini essay every day, starting on your 42nd birthday, going to your 43rd. You did miss a few days,
yeah.
But you did it for that whole year. I'm just going to say,
I
there are
like
not
the fourth
365.
Day. Yeah, 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 I know.
You love words, and I love words, so I just want to, we're going to get into the book, but okay. I just tease this out, because
yeah.
I did not know that the word essay in French means to try or to attempt.
Yeah.
So great.
Isn't that great?
Yeah.
And when you tell, I mean, it's the best thing when I tell students who are like in, you know, having to write
anguished
essays,
about writing an essay.
Oh my God. It just, they're just like, well, why am I doing what they're telling me to do all the time? You know, like, or why are they telling me to do this?
Yeah.
Have a thesis and then tell us why the thesis is true. No, don't do that. Just try.
Yeah. And then you also point out that delight, the word delight, suggests both of light and without light, which kind of points back at what you were just talking about.
Yeah, exactly, exactly, yeah. The delightful things that I'm sort of talking about in this book, so often when they're there, they also imply their absence, you know?
Mm-hmm. Do you have you thought much about what is the distinction between delight, pleasure, I don't know. You know, something people talk about a lot now is gratitude, a practice of gratitude.
Mm-hmm.
And it strikes me that this practice of daily delight has a kinship with that, but it's slightly different. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Did you think about what like really focusing on the word delight meant for you?
It just came in my ear. Like something delighted me and I was like, oh, it'd be a neat thing to write essays every day for a year about something that delighted me.
Yeah,
I mean, it came in my ear. It wasn't until literally the last day of writing it that someone sent me a card for my birthday and told me like what the etymology of delight was. And I was like, oh, I didn't even look up the word yet.
Right.
I mean, I kind of know what it means, you know, yeah. but obviously part of the fun was like inventing what it meant too and sort of theorizing it despite having not looked it up.
So what surprised you in the process of moving through that year and moving through that year looking for delight and writing about delight every day?
I mean, many things surprised me, I suppose. But one of the things that surprised me was how quickly the study of delight made delight more evident.
Mm-hmm.
That was really quick, you know, and I wasn't sure. Like, I was a little bit like, this is going to be hard, you know, to just, like, have something delightful happen every day, you know?
Yeah, but you said somewhere, it's like you developed a delight radar or a delight muscle.
Yeah.
Well, it seems to me it's a little bit, it's kind of the inverse or the, I don't know, the opposite experience from, like, going to the therapist every week where you're kind of saving up things that illustrate your neurosis.
Yeah, yeah,
and you were doing the opposite.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, exactly. Yeah, 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 yeah. Like, it's fun.
But
it
like,
fun.
So, but what are some of the things that you noticed that you found delightful and called delight that you wouldn't have imagined before you started?
You know, I mean, it just like occurred to me. It made me realize too how often I am delighted, how often things happen that, like you were doing this hand gesture and you were doing these hand gestures. I was like, I love hand gestures when you were doing that. I do them too, you know, with abundance. You know, I realized over the course of writing the book how much I love, I have a title of one of the pieces in there, but it's like unambiguous, how do I say it? Physical contact that is pleasant, you know, unambiguously pleasant public physical interactions, I think is what I call it. Yeah. You know, like I love how frequently I'm in the presence of like sweet little interactions that don't have to happen, but do have to happen, mm-hmm. you know?
I guess some that I noticed, just these ordinary things like seeing two people sharing the burden of carrying a shopping bag.
Yeah.
Or a sack of laundry.
Yeah.
How they're helping each other yeah. and how their bodies are adjusting to
it's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
It's an amazing thing.
Yeah.
But it's not until you say it's amazing, you right. know? It's like, whoa, that's amazing. We do that all the time.
Yeah.
I'm Krista Tippett, and this is On Being, today with writer and community gardener Ross Gay.
I think sometimes about this phrase, you know, made my day, that we have the power with our words and with all kinds of small gestures like that.
Mm-hmm.
Even like somebody being really nice in a checkout line, mm-hmm. or you being nice to somebody in a checkout line mm-hmm. after the last two people were really rude to them.
Yeah.
And you watch a transformation take place
mm-hmm.
that you made, that their day was getting broken and you made. What an incredible power we have to walk through the world making somebody's day.
Yeah, yeah. Just in a soft way. It's kind of amazing.
Yeah. There's also a lot of cafe runs.
Yeah. That's something,
there's
too.
There's a lot like, of, like, man, the I'm vegan donut that
yeah,
you haven't even eaten yet.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
But it's already delighting.
Yeah, yeah,
just
yeah.
the thought of getting
yeah,
to it.
Totally. Totally, yeah. Yeah. That's right.
And also arugula and greens and garlic from your garden.
Yeah, my garden. And it's funny because people, when they talk about the book, they notice the garden as like a primary feature of the
book. The garden
book.
Is actually a character in the
yeah,
book.
Yeah, yeah. And it didn't occur to me probably because it's so much, the garden is so much in my life, you know?
Well, I'd like to talk about that because I also feel like the garden becomes not just a metaphor, but a way that you also kind of work through the complexity of these ideas mm-hmm. about joy and delight and mm-hmm. what it means to be alive and mm-hmm. in relationship. Would you tell us about the Bloomington Community Orchard?
Oh, yeah. So that's the Bloomington Community Orchard is this public orchard that was started by a woman named Amy Countryman. And she gathered a bunch of people and basically, actually the cool story is that she wrote a thesis project, an undergraduate thesis project, which her advisor suggested she take to the urban forester. Bloomington's a pretty little town, so everyone in that way kind of knows each other. And the urban forester said, it was a good idea if you can show support.
We're in Bloomington, Indiana.
Oh, yeah, Bloomington, Indiana.
Yeah, yeah.
And the urban forester said, it's a good idea if you can show support. We'll give you a little seed money and let you use this acre of land that they were just mowing anyway. And she had a call-out meeting. A crowd like this showed up. And boom, boom, boom. You know, I don't know, several months later, we were planting an orchard. And it's, you know, it's this amazing place and it's, you know, maybe there's 100 fruit trees, all kinds of fruit
which
trees.
Which is so amazing, 100 different kinds of fruit. But it's not huge, right?
No. It's an acre. It's a football field in size. Yeah. Yeah.
And it was a dead zone before.
It was just lawn. It was just lawn, like super compacted lawn. So, you know, it's a benefit to the city that we're managing this property now. And obviously it's a benefit to the community.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's a magical place. Because it's trees and it's wonderful and it makes some food, but it's the real beautiful thing to me about it is that there's so much learning and community building going on in there. You know, it doesn't actually make a dent into like food security in what it produces. But that's not what it produces. What it produces is the community
mm-hmm.
Coming together, the sharing of knowledge, all that kind of stuff.
But it does sound like it's a place where anybody can walk up and take a piece of fruit.
You can walk right
which
up.
Which is not nothing. It's not food security, but nourishment.
Oh, totally. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it's not like bushels and bushels and bushels
right,
and
right.
bushels, what I'm saying.
I think this is a line from the website, free fruit for all. This is a big adjective. Yeah. Free fruit for all, food justice and joy project.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. It's pretty good.
Yeah.
It's pretty good. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's amazing. Like probably like hundreds and hundreds of people have taken classes at the orchard And those people then go and take that, you know, information wherever they do, either to their, you know, neighborhoods or, you know, some other orchard or whatever, you know. So that is a pretty wonderful project.
What trees do you head for when you go to the orchard?
We have really good, like our blackberries always do really good. So I'm pumped for the blackberries. We have a fig tree. And I always check on the fig tree because it came from my buddy's dad's yard in back in Levittown, Langhorne, Pennsylvania. And it's always like, it's always a little tricky for the figs to ripen up in Bloomington because it's, you know, because it's Indiana. And, but sometimes they do and they're incredible and, you know, apple, we have good apples, you know.
Yeah.
And it's organic, so, you know, everything looks like a real piece of fruit.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
You've said that that when you started growing things, your life got better.
Yeah. I mean, for one, it's just like, it's just fun to, like, be in a garden for me. Like, dreaming about what could happen. You know, that kind of, like, mystical space, actually, of, like, trying to figure out what this thing that I do here could be in 5 years, that kind of like strange dreaming space that it is. There's also something really moving about putting a seed in the ground and it turning into something really different, yeah. You know, and like a lot of something really different and potentially on and on and on a lot of something very different. You know, I'm crazy for smells, you know, and a garden gives you smells, you know. I'm nuts about that. I'm nuts about that. And I know the soil makes you happy too, putting your hands in soil, like we know that. Mm-hmm. There's many things. To walk out your door and like get a little food, I can go on and on about this, yeah.
No, but it's great. But this is an example of pointing out delights.
Yeah.
Like lingering with small things that are actually pretty big.
Totally, I mean, like that's what I think. Like when I look at a flower, whatever the flower is, like we're growing a really nice crop of dandelions right now. And just this year I was like, it's a crop, you know, it's a crop. But anyway, if you look, spend time looking at the flower, any flower or any, you know, anything, but, and gardens give you the opportunity because they also make you want to smell them and maybe taste them and all that. It's like, I've never seen anything. And you can do it again and again and again and again and again and again. It's crazy to me. Anyway, so you can tell, like, yes, it's made my life better.
Well, what also strikes me when you write about the garden is public space is also something you care about.
Yeah.
You go around looking for,
yeah.
Thinking about. I share that with you.
Mm-hmm.
And it strikes me that the gardening flows into that in interesting ways, mm-hmm. because it's also like when you write about it, okay, so here's a place you're writing about, that it's such a study in the interrelationship of things.
Yeah.
And if you put something here, it might not happen. And yeah. If you put it near this, it might yeah. not happen. But if you yeah. put these two things together,
mm-hmm.
and that it's also kind of, so there's this real rigor
yeah.
and sophistication that goes into it. And then there's also so much that's unexpected that
mm-hmm,
happens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, totally. And actually, when you said that, it made me think too, talking about public space, that it's also a thing that the orchard, you can always walk into the orchard. I want to say that, you know,
yeah.
because so much space becomes private these days.
Yeah.
That to have a space that's kind of like, no, you can just go there. You just go there. No, just go there. You know, it's a big deal.
Well, just how the garden, the complexity, it's a little microcosm of wholeness.
Yeah.
And the complexity of wholeness and the interrelationship of things.
Yeah, totally, right. And you're constantly sort of imagining, well, what if this was here and what if this was here and what if, you know, I'm always like trying to think of ways to sort of interact with bugs, say, that eat my plants, you know? And what if we had these things here? And what if yeah. we had, you know, what if we invited these things in
yeah.
the garden?
And then you have to think about what you know about what will happen.
Yeah, yeah.
If you put that there and
yeah.
if you put it there on its own or if yeah. you combine it with something else.
Yeah, yeah.
I do love that. Yeah, thinking about an orchard as public space.
Yeah.
A place where anybody can go grab some fruit.
Yeah, yeah. You could just be
mm-hmm.
and just hang around.
Mm-hmm.
Like hang around. that's a thing. I mean, like, to have a place where you can go hang around and not be told to leave.
Yeah.
You know?
I wanted to...
Can I read one?
Yes, please. Which, do you want this? Or you've got it.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's called Loitering. It fits what we've been talking about. Loitering. I'm sitting at a cafe in Detroit where in the door window is the sign with the commands, no soliciting, no loitering, stacked like an anvil. I have a fiscal relationship with this establishment, which I developed by buying a coffee and which makes me a patron. And so even though I subtly dozed in the late afternoon sun pouring under the awning, the $2 spent protects me, at least temporarily, from the designation of loiterer. Though the dozing, if done long enough, or ostentatiously enough, or with enough delight, might transgress me over. The Webster's definition of loiter reads thus, to stand or wait around idly without apparent purpose, and to travel indolently with frequent pauses. Among the synonyms for this behavior are linger, loaf, laze, lounge, lollygaggle, dawdle, amble, saunter, meander, putter, dilly-dally, and mosey. Any one of these words in the wrong frame of mind might be considered critique or noun epithet, lollygagger or loafer. Is lollygag a Minnesota thing? My mom says that all the time. Indeed, lollygag was one of the words my mom would use to cajole us while jingling her keys when she was waiting on us, which, judging from the visceral response I had while writing that memory, must have been not quite infrequent. All of these words to me imply having a nice day. They imply having the best day. They also imply being unproductive, which leads to being, even if only temporarily, non-consumptive. And this is a crime in America, and more explicitly criminal depending upon any number of quickly apprehended visual cues. Mm. It's two more pages. Should I finish it or should we?
It's great, yeah.
Finish
it? Yeah. Okay.
For instance, the darker your skin, the more likely you are to be loitering, though a Patagonia jacket could do some work to disrupt that perception. A Patagonia jacket, colorful pants, tree-torn sneakers with short socks, an Ivy League ball cap, and a thick book, not the Bible, and you're almost golden. Almost. There is a Venn diagram someone might design, several of them, that will make visual our constant internal negotiation towards safety. And like the best comedy, it will make us laugh hard before saying, Lord. It occurs to me that laughter and loitering are kissing cousins, as both bespeak an interruption of production and consumption. And it's probably for this reason that I've been among groups of non-white people laughing hard who have been shushed in a Qdoba in Bloomington, in a bar in Fishtown, in the Harvard Club at Harvard. The shushing, perhaps, reminds how threatening to the order are our bodies in non-productive, non-consumptive delight. The moment of laughter not only makes consumption impossible, you might choke. But if the laugh is hard enough, if the talk is just right, food or drink might fly from your mouth. If not, and this hurts, your nose. And if your body is supposed to be one of the consumables, if it has been, if it is one of the consumables around which so many ideas of production and consumption have been structured in this country, well, there you go. There is a Carrie Mae Weems photograph of a woman in what looks to be some kind of textile factory with an angel embroidered to the left breast of her shirt where her heart resides. The woman, like the angel, has her arms splayed wide almost in ecstasy, as though to embrace everything. So in the midst of her glee is she. Every time I see that photo, after I smile and have a genuine bodily opening on account of witnessing this delight, which is a moment of black delight, I look behind her for the boss. Uh-oh, I think you're in a moment of non-productive delight. Heads up. Which points to another of the synonyms for loitering, which I almost wrote as delight, taking one's time. Mm. For while the previous list of synonyms allude to time, taking one's time makes it kind of plain. For the crime of loitering, the idea of it, is about ownership of one's own time, which must be sometimes wrested from the assumed owners of it, who are not you, back to the rightful, who is. And while having interpolated the policing of delight such that I am on the lookout for the overseer, even in photos I have studied hundreds of times, on the lookout always for the policer of delight, my work is studying this kind of glee, being on the lookout for it, and aspiring to it, floating away from the factory, as she seems to be.
Hmm. We slightly shortened Ross Gay's reading of Loitering here for time, but you can find the whole essay in the unedited version of the On Being podcast, available wherever you like to listen. Also find this show again in our Poets and Poetry Library at onbeing.org. After a short break, more with Ross Gay.
On Being is brought to you by the John Templeton Foundation, harnessing the power of the sciences to explore the deepest and most perplexing questions facing humankind. In June, the foundation approved $85 million in new projects to accelerate discovery and inspire curiosity. Requests for funding will be accepted until August 16th. Learn more at templeton.org.
I'm Krista Tippett, and this is On Being. Today, reflecting on a practice of delight with the writer Ross Gay at the 2019 Wordplay Festival in Minneapolis.
I wanted to talk to you about justice, how you grapple with that, that reality, that aspiration, that concept. And there has been an evolution of that. You have brought together the idea of longing for justice and working for justice with also exalting the beautiful and tending to what one loves as much as what one must fight.
I mean, tending to what one loves feels like the crux. Yeah, I'm very confused about justice, I think. I feel like the way we think of justice is absolutely inadequate. Often, you know, not everyone. I am curious about a notion of justice that is in the process of exalting what it loves.
Yeah, so here's something you wrote somewhere. You said, "I often think the gap in our speaking about and for justice, our working for justice, is that we forget to advocate for what we love, for what we find beautiful and necessary. We are good at fighting, but imagining and holding in one's imagination what is wonderful and to be adored and preserved and exalted is harder for us, it seems."
I think so.
I mean, I think about journalism a lot and how, you know, when you talk about the delight, you developed a delight radar and a delight muscle. I mean, basically, journalism has a despair radar and a despair muscle.
Yeah, I know.
And yeah, and I also, and there's nothing, it's not that we don't need to know those things. It's not that those aren't part of the story. But I feel like what you're saying is, but it's, yeah, it's, that's what you mean, right? When you say it's inadequate.
Well, part of the story, that's the thing. Like, if the news was as invested in talking about how this person was great to that person as it was in talking about how that person was terrible to that person, it would be a radically different experience.
Yeah.
Like, it would be like, oh, okay, we live amongst people, you know? People do many things, you know? But it feels, I mean, part of what is, I think, is interesting about this book is that it brings to my attention, just clearer, like that many things are happening, you know, many things are happening. And like you said, like this sort of, it sells.
Right.
It sells.
Well, it also, our brains are kind of wired to get riveted by something that's scary.
Yeah.
That's threatening.
Yeah.
We like mobilize around that.
Right.
It's automatic.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I also think that the exercise of the book is to say, look how amazing this is.
Yeah, totally. And I also think...
And look how intricate it is.
And intricate and endless and like unbelievable. And I also think that there's a part of our bodies that are wired. And this is a thing that I noticed, that when I would experience something delightful, sometimes I'd be like, oh, that's wonderful. But so often I'd be like, I want to tell you. Mm-hmm. Like it is this thing that actually makes me reach out towards someone, right. You know? And that feels bodily. That feels, I don't know if a scientist has found this out yet, but like when something good happens, you know, do we sort of gather around a thing? It is a feeling that I have, a deep feeling that I have. And I feel like it's something that I witness too.
Yeah.
And people kind of want to share the stuff that they love, you know?
Yeah. And well, what you do is you put vivid language to it. You put beautiful, riveting words to it.
Yeah.
Because there's a little bit of discipline involved.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But that shifts it too to being more interesting.
Yeah. How do you mean?
Well, I mean that if we acknowledge this reality that on autopilot we're going to be galvanized by something terrible coming at us, then those of us who care about getting this other story about ourselves and the world out there have to also apply some intelligence to doing that well, so that it will also rivet, and it's with this care with words and stories, which we do respond to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think it also sort of knows or comes to know that what is galvanizing as well is what we love.
Yeah.
And has a kind of belief in that and like, you know.
Yes.
And also like believes in the thing of, I mean, the book itself believes that it's elbowing its neighbor and being like, right?
Yeah.
Look at all this, you know, what do you love? What do you love? You know?
Yeah. You know, there's this line, this famous line from Cornel West that justice is love made public, which I think has wisdom in it. And I also don't think it's a big enough statement. And, you know, and I feel like you put in your writing and your other writing and your work, like the Tenderness Project.
I feel like
what you're trying to do with that is so... You know, let's give some complexity and some texture to that, what love made public is and how it works. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, just that simple word, justice, doesn't do it. Yeah. So the Tenderness Project. Talk about that.
You know, my friend Shayla and I were talking about just like what might be a nice project to do these days. And... So we decided to start this thing called the Tenderness Project, and it's, you know, every 10 days or so, someone will release a tenderness, we call them, and they can be like a little essay.
Tendernesses.
Yeah, tendernesses, yeah.
I think the website is like tendernesses.com.
Yeah, and it can be an essay or a poem or a little film or something. But it's just like small, you know, I get a lot of emails that are not like, here's a tenderness, you know. Yeah. A lot of them are like, you know, watch out.
Right.
And
right.
And like when you see one that says, here's a tenderness, it's like, oh, wow, that's okay, you know.
And that's also just such a good example of, because we are riveted by this idea. I think everybody in this room, like just, oh yeah, tenderness, right? Tenderness is, but it's a softer place in us.
Mm-hmm. It's many things. That's the thing, too, right? Like, tenderness, it is a softer place in us.
I mean, the part of us that gets interested in it.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, exactly, right. Yeah, and sometimes we're probably skeptical of it.
Uh-huh.
And we defend against it in ourselves and others, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
But I love the word tender because it is like it implies the sort of softness of us or the vulnerability.
Mm-hmm.
It also implies one who tends.
Mm-hmm.
It also is an exchange. You know, so tender is many things, you know, to be tender, to be engaged in tenderness is many things. And those things are, they also imply, I think, an other, you know.
Yes.
They imply, like, if you're tender, you're tender because you know that there are other things. Yeah. There are other people or other.
I also feel like I think almost anybody would have, like, I think there are memories in my body. So when the language of tenderness comes up, it is transformative. It's one of those ordinary transformative experiences.
The experience of tenderness.
Of either receiving it or showing it.
Yeah. I often think, when I think of tenderness, I think of my father. We had years we didn't get along at all, but he could not put his hand in my hair and kind of like move my head around, you know? And I just like, we mostly didn't talk for a while, and like, but he couldn't not touch me.
Yeah.
And that's like, and then we could go on and on and on and on and on and on with that.
You also wrote, yeah, I also want to note that you also write a lot about football.
Yeah.
And right? And you played football.
I did.
And so you think about tenderness very much in touch with a culture of violence that we also live with, and that's strangely intertwined with fun and joy and love and all these beautiful things.
Yeah. I played college football, and I got a scholarship because I could hurt people. Basically, that's what it is.
Yeah.
Sometimes people are like, well, aren't you like skilled at the game? No. I mean, yeah, but because I could hurt people, you know, that's what it is. And in the midst of that as well, in addition to all kinds of, you know, brutality and stupidity, is all this tenderness, you know?
Yeah.
That, in fact, you know, some of the tenderness I think of is like having my right MCL blown out by a good shot block from someone, and my buddy Glenn like running to pick me up, you know? So you're right. It's very much entwined in the way probably I've been thinking about it for most of my life, because for most of my life, I've been deeply engaged in thinking about sport and the violence in sport. I've been in sport, or I've been thinking about sport and the many things that sport is.
I'm Krista Tippett, and this is On Being, today with writer and community gardener Ross Gay.
We want to hear some more of you, but just before that also, you did write this, I think more on this theme of, if you know, justice is love made public, but more contour to love made public. And you've also been writing about mercy.
Mm-hmm.
With this beautiful piece in the Sun. Just want to spend a couple minutes on this. It's so striking to me. Back to your garden. Because it starts with you doing potatoes and chard and garlic, and your back seizes up.
Mm-hmm.
And you realize eventually that has to do with an experience that you had, that your body is taking in this experience you had with the police the night before.
Mm-hmm.
But where you go with mercy, like with tenderness, is that it may be the only, that we have to say everything that needs to be said and reveal everything that needs to be revealed, and then make this other move, which again is kind of that beyond of mere justice. I don't know. How would you?
Say it again. Would you ask it again?
I just want. Well, I'm sure somebody's asked you this.
Yeah.
It's like, how can you use a word like joy right now?
Yeah.
How can you use a lower word like mercy right now? Being a black man and doing nothing wrong and having to constantly think about what's going to happen when you see a policeman.
Yeah.
For example.
Yeah. I don't know. You know, that piece remains a puzzle to me. And what's interesting to me about that essay is that there aren't answers.
No.
Yeah.
No.
But there's a fundamental question, which is like, we ought to know each other better.
Yes, but that's a different move.
Yeah.
There's no answer, but there's a move. I mean, here's a little piece of it. What if we honestly assess what we have come to believe about ourselves and each other, and how those beliefs shape our lives, And what if we did it with generosity and forgiveness? What if we did it with mercy? And you're talking about really hard, mm-hmm. inexcusable things in our history and our present. Mm-hmm. And you wrote, the corrupt imagination might become visible. Inequalities might become visible. Violence might become visible. Terror might become visible. And the things we've been doing to each other, despite the fact that we don't want to do such things to each other, might become visible. If we don't, we will all remain phantoms. And as it turns out, it's hard for phantoms to care for one another, let alone love one another.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to say. That's it.
Yeah. I often ask a question about if somebody at the end of an interview, like, what's making you despair today and where are you finding hope? And I don't want to ask you about despair. Mm-hmm. What is giving you delight today? Is there any little thing, something small or large, what comes to mind?
Oh, I mean, like, the way these lights are working is pretty amazing. Some of the reflections up there. There was someone up here who had a very precise, beautiful laugh that was... that's kind of nice, just to be in a room with people laughing. There was a couch in the room back there, in the not quite the changing room, but it's a very nice looking couch, I thought. Mm-hmm. I had a nice little rest before I came over here, at the green room, I guess they call it. Those were all delightful things. Mm-hmm.
Have you done kettlebells today?
I was hoping you were going to ask. I didn't know that I was like,
we realized something we have in common. Yeah. Can't talk about it. We don't have time, but that would be a delight.
Yeah, totally. I did not do kettlebells
swinging
today, but I will. Yeah, I will probably tomorrow.
Okay,
yeah.
Oh, good. Would you read just from here on page 49 and just to the end of that? This is from the Book of Delights.
Yeah. Among the most beautiful things I've ever heard anyone say came from my student, Bethany, talking about her pedagogical aspirations or ethos, how she wanted to be as a teacher, and what she wanted her classrooms to be. She said, "What if we joined our wildernesses together?" Sit with that for a minute. That the body, the life, might carry a wilderness, an unexplored territory, and that yours and mine might somewhere, somehow meet, might even join. And what if the wilderness, perhaps the densest wild in there, thickets, bogs, swamps, uncrossable ravines and rivers, have I made the metaphor clear, is our sorrow? Or, to use Smith's term, the intolerable. It astonishes me sometimes, no, often, how every person I get to know, everyone, regardless of everything, by which I mean everything, lives with some profound personal sorrow. Brother addicted, mother murdered, dad died in surgery, rejected by their family, cancer came back, evicted, fetus not okay. Everyone, regardless, always, of everything. Not to mention the existential sorrow we all might be afflicted with, which is that we and what we love will soon be annihilated. Which sounds more dramatic than it might. Let me just say dead. Is this sorrow, of which our impending being no more might be the foundation, the great wilderness? Is sorrow the true wild? And if it is, and if we join them, your wild to mine, what's that? For joining, too, is a kind of annihilation. What if we joined our sorrows, I'm saying? I'm saying, what if that is joy?
Ross Gay, thank you.
Thank you.
Ross Gay lives in Bloomington, Indiana, where he's a professor of English at Indiana University. His books include the poetry collection Catalog of Unabashed Gratitude and a book of essays, The Book of Delights. He co-founded the Tenderness Project together with Shayla Lawson.
On Being Project is
Chris Heagle,
Lily Percy,
Maya Tarrell,
Marie Sambalay,
Aaron Farrell,
Lauren Dordal,
Tony Liu,
Aaron Colasacco,
Kristen Lin,
Prophet Adewu,
Eddie Gonzalez,
Lillian Vo,
Lucas Johnson,
Damon Lee,
Suzette Burley,
Katie Gordon,
Zach Rose,
Siri Grassley,
and Nicole Finn.
Special thanks this week to Steph Opitz, Mitch Baird, Nick Tranby, Matthew Koch, and all the great people at Wordplay, the Guthrie Theater, and the Loft Literary Center. The On Being Project is located on Dakota land. Our lovely theme music is provided and composed by Zoe Keating. And the last voice that you hear singing at the end of our show is Cameron Kinghorn. On Being is an independent production of the On Being Project. It's distributed to public radio stations by PRX. I created this show at American Public Media. Our funding partners include the Fetzer Institute, helping to build the spiritual foundation for a loving world. Find them at fetzer.org. Kalliopeia Foundation, working to create a future where universal spiritual values form the foundation of how we care for our common home. Humanity United, advancing human dignity at home and around the world. Find out more at humanityunited.org, part of the Omidyar Group. The Osprey Foundation, a catalyst for empowered, healthy, and fulfilled lives. And the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interests in religion, community development, and education.
On Being is produced by On Being Studios in Minneapolis, Minnesota.